Post-Harlan Monologics. Number 00067. Recorded on February 14, 2024. Production location, Post. Harlan. Texas. Blue Valentines, Part 2, Chapter 67.
The opinions of Maverick 88 are not necessarily the opinions of Maverick 88. Sensitive content warning. Viewer discretion is advised.
Now, buckle up. You are on the runaway train of thought. Ladies and gentlemen, without any further ado, the one, the only, Maverick 88. This monologue is continued from the previous episode, Chapter 00066, Blue Valentines, Part 1.
Indeed. My very own self-imposed time restrictions have forced me to double down this week, bust out this week's post-Harlan monologics into two episodes. So we'll be working on the finalization of Blue Valentines. The Blue Valentines. So where did I leave off? I was talking about all this pawn shop stuff, right? My wife and I did this great pawn shop hopping excursion a couple of weekends ago and came out of it with a TV and a gaming console and a little bit of this and a little bit of that. And, I started to talk about the pawn shop business, you know, what I was able to learn about it, observing on television shows, like Pawn Stars on the History Channel. And, there's another one or two of them out there also, not quite as good, but, I learned a little bit about the business, A, watching what they were doing there on TV, and B, actually dealing with guys in pawn shops over the years, right? Now, where I grew up, it just wasn't pawn shop. I can't think of one pawn shop anywhere in New Jersey. I'm not saying there wasn't any. I just never saw them. I don't think I saw a pawn shop in my life until I was in the Marine Corps in Oceanside, California. I remember walking down the strip in that town and there was a pawn shop. And I went in. It was the first time I ever saw one. I went in and checked it out, right? But I went, 19 years of my life having had not seen a pawn shop before, been in one. So it's not that common up there, but down south they're all over the place, right? Every town's got at least one of them, it seems, here in Texas. And I just remember across the south there's pawn shop here, pawn shop there. It's a way people do things, right? And I think it's legitimate, you know. I don't think it's any kind of like scumbag deal or anything like that. You often will have a pawn shop in a seedy neighborhood and you'll have some kind of sketchy people. You know, a lot of thieves will steal things from houses, burglarize houses or cars or something. Steal things for their drug habits and go to the pawn shop and just try to sell it off for whatever they can get. I mean, that brings that skeezy element into the pawn shop. But as a business, what they do, I think it's reasonable, fair business practice. What I mean to say, this is what happens in a pawn shop, you see. people come in, like I talked about, I used a burglar, thieves as an example, but people who need money and need it now have the opportunity to take some kind of article that has some kind of marketable value, bring it to a pawn shop, and instead of seeking out the perfect buyer at the highest price, they'll take a buyer at a lower price for the right here, right now factor of it all. Capiche? Right? You don't have to go through the bother. Like, I remember when I was back in Tennessee and I was packing up to leave at the end of that really gruesome family story. It just sucked. Everything sucked. But I needed to get some money up. I needed to unload some stuff because I was carrying too much on me. And I was trying to sell off some guitars that I had. And I wasn't willing to go to the lowest possible price. I was trying to squeeze every dollar out of it because I really didn't want to get rid of the guitars. If I was going to get rid of them, I wanted fair market value. I researched it out. I saw what it was. And I went on, you know, back then it was Craigslist. You sold everything on. And I couldn't get rid of them, you know. Eventually, if I would have waited 4, 5, 6 months, somebody would have finally come by and gave me what I wanted for it. And that's the problem. You need the money right here, right now. You're not going to get top dollar right here, right now, unless you walk right into the perfect market for it all. There's an always market in a pawn shop, but they're going to come in, like I said. They're going to figure out what the actual value is of your used whatever and go right to 50% of that, right? They'll just cut it right in half and say this is what they'll offer. And then you got to try to haggle them up from there, you know? And their profit margin lies somewhere in between that 50% they're offering you and the actual worth of the thing, right? So the lower, obviously, the lower that they can go with the price, the lower that you accept, the more room they have for haggling with the buyer when the buyer comes in, right? So that's one part of the business anyway. And I've pretty much expressed it well enough right there. You know, you're going to get the low price for the here and now. You know, the immediate need for money is solved, but you're going to not get anywhere near the market value because you're selling to a reseller. The reseller's got to make a profit. That's reasonable. That's fair. The other end of the business, you know, pawning is really using your marketable knickknacks, whatever, you know, guns, guitars, appliances, tools, jewelry, whatever it is, if it's something the pawn shop can resell, they'll make that same kind of arrangement with you, but they can also do it on terms of a borrowing, right? You can borrow against the collateral of your whatever you're bringing in at that same cutthroat price, you know, 50% or whatever. And if you can come up with the money that you borrow within whatever your time frame is, a month or something like that, you can basically buy it back, right? So if you need like to borrow money right now that you can pay back easily in a month from now, right? That's another way the pawn shops do business. If you fail, they'll put your item on the shelf. See, in a pawn shop, they got to keep an inventory, right? They start doing these things. They have these pawn arrangements, these loans, and buybacks, and they have to store the stuff. So storage is a premium for them. So they have to, invest in the real estate. They have to have capital to purchase all this stuff that's coming in from the crack addicts off the street and other kind of desperados and, you know, whoever, right? It's a business. It's legitimate. They take the risk. They have to do all the marketing and reselling and all that. It makes sense, right? And I think it's a fair deal. I like being on the buyer side of it because you can do pretty well there. They'll make money at 75%. They'll make plenty of money at 75% of the street value of whatever they're selling. You want to go in there and buy a guitar that's worth $1,000. You know that they probably paid somewhere around $500 for it. If you offer them $700, $750, there's a really good chance they'll take it, right? But your problem there is, do they have the guitar that you want on hand? Right, you just got to stumble into something and get lucky like that, like I did a couple of weeks ago with that Fender Acoustasonic Jazzmaster. That was a desirable guitar for me at a very ridiculously reasonable price that I probably could have haggled down another $100. You know, I feel that way with the conversation I had with the guy about it. I could have walked out of there for $900 with that great guitar, and that would have been 50% of its value, but they just had to move it. Anyway, I'm talking about how the business is done. Why am I saying this? Because, A, there's people in this world, in this country, that don't know really what a pawn shop is all about, because it's not prevalent in their area. And B, you may be listening to this recording 50, 100 years in the future in a time where there's no such thing as pawn shops. It may be the case. I don't know. Things can be really weird in the next 50 to 100 years, right? So who knows? So that's a little bit about the pawn shop business. Now, I talked about this little excursion my wife and I did a few weekends ago where we were, quote unquote, pawn shop hopping, right? Just a random adventure to various pawn shops in different towns around the eastern half of DFW, right? And what I never did, though, was actually give you the name of the place. And that's kind of unfair, right? The different pawn shops we went to. I told you, we ended up stopping at three of them. And then we were done. We spent money and we were done. We were going to go to like six, but we did three. The first one we went to was in Wylie, Texas. It's called Texas Dollar Pawn and Gun, right? Texas Dollar Pawn and Gun. Down in Rockwall, and the one in Wylie's on State Highway 78, right? And Rockwall, the pawn shop there was called, go figure, Rockwall Pawn, right? And that's on Interstate 30, right? On the eastbound side, Interstate 30, on the service road over there. The one in Rowlett, which is owned by the same people who own that Rockwall Pawn that I was just talking about, is called Rowlett Jewelry and Pawn, and that is on Highway 66. Now, not to be confused with the Route 66 that runs between Chicago and the pier in Santa Monica in California, right? With all the ghost towns in the desert and all that. Different 66. This is your Texas State 66, not U.S. 66. So there. So we walked out of all these pawn shops. Like I said, we bought a 65-inch TV that we had to mount on the wall right away. We got it at a pretty deep discount because it didn't come with any kind of stand, you know, any kind of little footies or booties or whatever you want to call it to make it stand up on top of a table or a floor or whatever. Whatever people do with TVs, I don't know. I see a TV that big and that flat, that's automatically hanging on the wall. So I didn't have a problem with that. We just had to, like I said, get the apparatus to bracket that thing up. And we did that immediately, and it's done, and that's it. That TV is going to probably be there for a very long time now because it was a little bit of a pain in the ass, you know? A little bit of a pain in the ass. Just a little bit. Most of it my fault. It probably could have been as simple as I imagined it to be. But anyway, let's get away from that for now. We got this TV. We got the PlayStation 3. PS3 video game console / Bluetooth player / DVD player / wireless internet interface, whatever. It's all this different stuff, right? And we bought it on a rainy day, right? It was a rainy day excursion to just get out and do something because of all these the recurring rainy weekends we've been having here for the past month, 2 months almost. So we bought on a rainy day stuff for a rainy day, right? So when we have rainy, you know, washout weekends, we could just sit there and be with each other and then goof off and play video games. And this is an aspect of the wonderful relationship I have with my wife that we really haven't delved into very much, you know. For example, what I mean to say is, you know, when you're dating somebody and you get along well, and you're kind of in this groove, and you're so agreeable on everything, and then you sit down at a table and play board games, maybe with another couple, and you see this other side of this person that you were with that you had no idea existed, right? Right? All of a sudden, like, the killer instinct comes out. Like, holy shit, who am I dating, right? Have you ever had that kind of experience? You know, people just get into, like, a competitive environment and show their ass, as we say down south, right? And my wife is not like that. She's steady as she goes, but it was very interesting, right? Very interesting to watch her sit down on a rainy day and play video games, right? The video games I like to play, she plays like on her phone, but she doesn't play like the 3D shooter and all these killer things that I do, right? She's seen her boys play him over the years. She's not completely unfamiliar. And, we spent, what was it? It started raining on Friday. It rained all day Sunday, Saturday, and it rained most of the day Sunday. It was just a gloomy weekend. And on the Friday night, we broke out Need for Speed Most Wanted, right? Need for Speed Most Wanted. I played that game with my stepsons back when it came out. And, there's all these racing missions. It's a race game, right? It's an auto race game. So there's races that you do. And as you win the races, it opens up other cars that you can acquire and different kinds of, like, accessories and parts for cars that you can buy. Things like that, right? It's that kind of game. But the graphics are really great, you know? For that time, they were exceptionally realistic. And it's just fun racing around, battering things. You know, the car takes a beating. A real car or truck driving around like that, you hit something, it's wrecked. That game, you keep on hitting crap, and maybe like the quarter panel fender will fall off, you know, maybe you'll get a flat tire or some shit, you know. But it ends up being kind of like Dukes of Hazzard. You could just start free riding around, and you see a cop, you go crash into him, and then all the cops come after you, and you try to flee from them, you know. Just watching my wife get giddy with excitement over that whole thing as she's trying to speed away from the police. She's got one on her tail, and here's one coming up in front of her, and she just turns a little bit, bam, right into the thing. The car, blows up, spins around, and then, you ride off into the sunset, and she loved that. And then Saturday, we started playing Grand Theft Auto, and this was her choice, right? Grand Theft Auto. And the most recent one that we can, I don't even know how many there are now, to be honest with you. The last one I ever played was Grand Theft Auto 5. I never finished it. The last one I finished was Grand Theft Auto 4. The first one I ever played was the third one, which is called Grand Theft Auto San Andreas. I played the hell out of that game, right? And those were the days I played it on the PC. So I had that kind of, the keyboard and mouse control, which I prefer. I honestly do. I can't get along with the video game console controller. I just never have really gotten along with it. And I struggle with it. Playing Grand Theft Auto, like trying to land a jet, like land an airplane. I have a lot of difficulty with that, where it used to be so easy to do, right? So anyway, so watching her, right? Watching her Need for Speed Most Wanted. We started playing Grand Theft Auto 5. That's the newest one that you could play on the PS3, right? I know there's at least a sixth, I'm pretty sure there's a sixth one out there. But I don't know anything about it, right? But again, cheering my wife on as she plays was probably more fun than me sitting there playing. You know what I mean? And some of these games, the graphics are so good and they're just so interesting and comical that it's sort of kind of like watching TV, and it's sort of like interactive. You know, you're interactive with the TV. Obviously, you're playing the game. You're controlling a character. But as a spectator, you're watching this interaction, and I'm watching my wife, you know. I give her the controller, and she plays Grand Theft Auto for the first time. And she walks out of wherever she was beginning from. I don't know, maybe I got arrested or wasted, as they say, shot, and I handed a controller over to her. She walks out onto the street. There's two women standing there on the corner. She walks right up the first one. I just backhand slap right upside the head, knocks a woman on her ass, you know. It's the look on her face and the laughter that came out of her. It was just something else, you know, because there's something in these video games, like you can do the things that you wish to do emotionally in this rotten world, but you won't do because it's uncivil and immoral, right? You can live out some of that stuff and kind of get it off your chest, you know, move away from it when you're done and walk into the reality with a lot less desire to actually go smack someone upside the head. But she got such a thrill out of that, and I got such a thrill out of watching her get such a thrill. You know what I mean? It's funny. You know, it's just funny. And now we can even do that on weeknights at the end of the day. You know, we sit down, we powwow with each other about each other's day, and we start to settle in. You could throw that up there for a half hour, an hour, and just go around, running around, you know. And we graduated from, backhanding somebody upside the head on a street corner to, like, throwing grenades at people, things like that, cops, getting into the big battles with the cops, you get a sniper perch and start chucking grenades down and see how many you could kill, see how long you could last. that sort of stuff. Just having a lot of fun with it. Just a lot of fun with it. So send me blue valentines all the way from Philadelphia to mark the anniversary of someone that I used to be. And I feel like a warrant is out from my arrest. Baby, you got me checking in my rearview mirror. That's why I'm always on the run. That's why I changed my name. And I didn't think you'd ever find me here to send me blue valentines, like half forgotten dreams, like a pebble in my shoe as I walk these streets, and so on and so on, right? And that, of course, right there is a snippet of the lyrics of the song Blue Valentines by Tom Waits from the LP Blue Valentine, released in 1978, which was a transitional year for me that I don't look back on very fondly, not to get into it, but 1978 was a year that, one of those years that we were moved around again. We went from one school to another, and but Tom Waits, Blue Valentines. Now, why? Why do I just drop that on you out of the blue? Well, today is Valentine's Day. Yes, Valentine's Day. And on Valentine's Day, it's, I got a friend of mine, right? The guy who turned me on to Tom Waits, you know, a classmate of mine, you know, going all the way back. We've known each other, I don't know how long, sixth grade, something like that. And we still keep in touch periodically. He's the guy who tells me who died, right? Oh, and our friends, when one of our friends dies, I get a message from this guy, right? Not lately, thankfully. It's, the deaths have not been coming as frequently as they did there for a minute. But the guy who turned me on to Tom Waits, still a fan of Tom Waits, as am I. And on Valentine's Day this morning, he posted the song that I just sang, sort of, kind of, Blue Valentines by Tom Waits. You know, that got my gears in motion for the day. Now, when I hear that song, there's nothing really romantic about it. It's the tragedy of romance. And, you know, that's a reality. Tragedy of romance. Just the whole idea of Valentine's Day. There are winners, there are losers in Valentine's Day, right? In fact, the way I look at it goes back to this very principle I brought up earlier. The whole two-thirds / 66.6% thing, right? The two-thirds theory. Oh, Valentine's, you got another sequence of three, and two of them are kind of like Valentine's Day losers, right? It goes like this. You know, Valentine's, first of all, you have the haves and the have-nots, right? Haves and the have-nots. The haves are somebody who has a romantic interest on Valentine's Day. The have-nots are home alone, right? Home alone. So that's the first split. But then you put the home alone people aside and just look at the ones who have somebody. And then there's a split there. There's a divide there. What's that divide? That divide is those who actually have a nice romantic Valentine's Day and those whose relationships blow up and go to hell as a result of Valentine's Day, right? How does this happen? How does this happen? Let me tell you, this happens like this. You know, you got some people with some expectations, right? And you may be, and I'll tell a story about this later on too, right? But you may be like dating somebody. You might be in these early stages of a relationship and along comes Valentine's Day, right? Now, what do you do? Now, some people will just punk out and say, yeah, you know what? Nah, I'm not going to go in for this whole gift-giving thing. I haven't known this person long enough, right? And that's an adequate strategy if you're willing to just dump this person, right? But if you're going to stay in it, now you've got the dilemma of what's too much, what's overdoing it, what's underdoing it, And how do you find that happy medium right in between, right? You overdo it, you can scare somebody away. You don't come out with like diamond rings and really expensive stuff, especially stuff that's suggestive, symbolic, you know, like an engagement ring, for an example, right? A little over the top when you're just dating somebody. And if you're dating somebody who has a conscience, right, a woman with a conscience, there is such a thing. Don't get me wrong, there is such a thing. Even if it's not symbolic or suggestive of like an engagement, like a ring would be, something stupid expensive that early on says something about you and your foolish judgment, right? And it really expresses that the two of you are not on the same plane and la-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. So it's difficult. You don't want to overdo it with your zealous feelings of romanticness, right? Of romance. And on the other hand, you don't want to underdo it either. You don't want to minimize the whole, the ambiance of Valentine's Day. You're holding somebody in a particular high esteem, but if that esteem is not high enough, you may find yourself frowned upon, right? Finding the balance at that stage is really lucky, really lucky. And I guess you could play it a whole lot of different ways as you go through life. You figure it out for yourself as you go. I'm not here giving you dating advice or anything like that. I've won some, I've lost some. It's just a reality. It's people. And there's a lot of things about people you don't know. That's why you date, right? That's why you date. So yeah, there's winners and there's losers. Now, the two-thirds theory is like this. Two-thirds of the people who engage in the Valentine's Day, or who encounter Valentine's Day, they're losers. One-third, it comes off well, right? The rest, you know, when you're dating, it's early like that, or you got nobody, it's your two-thirds, right? Valentine's Day is a shit deal. And I got to tell you something. The original intent of Valentine's Day was not so wide open, so ambiguous, to include anything and everything romantic, right? Like it is now, the secular version of it. It was a religious thing in the beginning, inspired by an actual saint named Valentine, who gave his life for the cause of marriage, right? He was a martyr, early church martyr, a priest from Rome, a presbyter from Rome, long before the Great Schism occurred, when all Christianity was still orthodox, right? There was an edict in the Roman Empire at that time, under the Emperor Claudius II, which mandated all men to serve in the military before they were allowed to get married. And of course, this priest, that's stupid, right? So he married people who were wanting to be married without any military service in their background. This pissed the emperor off, and this guy got martyred, right? Badly, I might add. Badly. Let me tell you about this Orthodox Saint Valentine a little bit more, right? That's a basic story, but the point is this. Before I get into that, it was always about marriage, not romance in general. Now we have problems with this quote-unquote Valentine's Day, where two-thirds of the people who encounter it have difficulties, or on the losing end of the game, right? And the reason is that was never meant to be that way. This is always supposed to be about marriage for the married, like we do with our celebration of wedding anniversaries, right? Saint Valentine's Day initially was a commemoration of marriage. But now you include all this other stuff where it becomes quote-unquote westernized and quote-unquote secularized, and it becomes this insane clown theater for so many people. Boy, I got stories too. I've not in my life been a friend of Valentine's Day, right? I've been on the wrong end of that one time too many. It's really difficult on the guys. particularly. This is really a girl receives holiday, and the guy's got to figure out how to go about it and make everybody happy, right? It's a real challenge, a real challenge. So let me tell you about this here Orthodox Saint Valentine, I keep on saying. I'm going to read from a website. This is the Greek Orthodox Church website. The historical and Orthodox Saint Valentine, right? Now a commercialized holiday celebrating modern Western courtship and romance, like I just described, the ancient Christian origins of St. Valentine's Day are largely forgotten. The actual Orthodox liturgical feast, Days of Valentinos, commemorate two early Christian saints, St. Valentine the Presbyter of Rome on July 6th, that's Orthodox St. Valentine's Day is July 6th, and another guy, a hero martyr, Valentine, a bishop of Interna. I can't do that word, all right? And both in Italy, right? Central Italy. His day is July 30th. So you got two St. Valentines here, right? Here's what happens. Although the historical records for these two saints are not complete, and what we do know about their lives has often been subjected to considerable confusion, their martyrdoms are well known to us. Because of their refusal to renounce their faith in Christ, both Valentines were imprisoned, tortured, and executed around the year 270 AD, right? 3rd century, Anno Domini, during the persecution of Christians under the Roman Empire, as I said before, Claudius II. Because they shared the same name, were contemporaries, resided near each other in central Italy, and ultimately shared similar fates. The two Valentines' personal histories were intermingled and conflated over the centuries, producing inconsistencies and puzzlement in many accounts of their lives. What most sources indicate, however, is that Bishop Valentine was renowned during his lifetime as a healer of the sick and blind, while Valentine the Presbyter, right, the priest guy who I'm talking about, would become notable in the historical memory of Christians, originally both Eastern and Western, right? Right? Eastern Orthodoxy, Roman Catholicism, before the split, right? Here's where the origins are. As a courageous steward of, drum roll please, marriage. Indeed, because of his connection to the sacrament of marriage, it would be the latter Valentine, the presbyter from Rome, who would serve as the inspiration for the late medieval Western literary foundations for what would, by the 19th century, evolve into today's popular secular Valentine's Day. All right, and I already explained how he drew the ire, this Saint Valentine, the presbyter in Rome, of Emperor Claudius II, and got his head handed to him. Or however he was killed specifically. I do not know. I could read more, but I don't want to hang you on that. But see, there's the saints, the Saint Valentine's, the specific presbyter, the priest, Saint Valentine of Rome. His defense and courage with regards to the institute of marriage, institution of marriage, I should say, and then kind of a winding story of how everything became westernized over time to this secular rendition of Valentine's Day that we frankly struggle with today because it's done wrongfully for the wrong reasons. This secular version, this is the thing, and maybe 50 years from now, maybe 100 years from now for you people way out in the future, maybe there is no such thing as Valentine's Day anymore out there. Maybe there's no such things as romance and sex. Maybe you reproduce dicklessly, you know, modern technology and all, and petri dishes and transhumanism and all these wonderful, spectacular ambitions of the corrupt, disgusting technocrat elitists in this world. Who knows? You may not have such provincial customs tallied up in your calendars. What we're doing here, customarily with this secular Valentine's Day, is centered around Hallmark cards and red roses, a dozen red roses, and a heart-shaped box of chocolates. All right, that's kind of like the core ensemble of customary gift-giving involved with this secular Valentine's Day, right? And then, depending, you could take it further. Romantic dinners. More exclusive restaurants for your romantic dinners. The gift-giving could include jewelry and more expensive jewelry. It can go to extremes to buying a person a house or a car, right? It gets like that. Expectations of certain types of women can be that way, which brings another difficulty into the picture. Even if you are married, if 1 year you went crazy and bought your wife all this expensive jewelry, what happens next year when you don't? You put yourself in this position where year after year you got to kind of top what you did the year before. And that'll make you crazy too. A good woman won't demand that sort of thing. It's not necessarily a worry for everybody, probably not even most people, but I could tell you. Where I was running around in my quote-unquote playa years, it is a very materialistic culture, right? Way different than the South. Way different than the South. Anyway, all that. Now, I mentioned heart-shaped box of chocolates and all that rigmarole, right? As part of the custom and tradition of the secular Valentine's Day as we observe it. And there's a song by Nirvana, right? Which is interesting. It segues along the lines of this heart-shaped box, right? The song is called Heart-Shaped Box, but also the lyrical content of the song, the meaning of the lyrics in the song, harkens back to the Meatloaf song that I brought up earlier, Two Out of Three Ain't Bad, where you have, and I'll describe it to you because you get it. This is actually a professional, part of a professional review of the song Heart-Shaped Box that I just pulled down off the internet. Reading a lot to you today too, but I can do that. You know why? Because I sang to you. If I sing to you, I can read to you, right? That's fair. I'm not gonna do this shit all the time. The first single from In Utero, right? That's a Nirvana album from the early 90s. Heart-Shaped Box details the battle of wills inherent to a new relationship when one doesn't quite feel so strongly about another person, right? That's what's like the Meatloaf song. Two out of three ain't bad, right? How does it go? I want you, I need you, but there ain't no way I'm ever gonna love you. Don't be sad. Two out of three ain't bad, right? Right? One of the people in the relationship just does not have the wheels under them to prefer things further, right? And I've always called it the imbalance, right? You get in a relationship where there's an imbalance. I like the girl way more than she likes me. The girl likes me way more than I like her. And you try to just go forward with it, and it's all out of whack. It's all out of sync. And it doesn't generally fly. Sooner or later, it just collapses with the imbalance. Usually, as you're dating, it's usually the case where somebody's more into the other person. Rarely is it that kismet, that equal balance. And when it is, things kind of go easy. But that doesn't solve everything either. Relationships are difficult, all right? And I need to remind myself of this. I don't really need to at this point, but it doesn't hurt to, right? Just to hold my wife in esteem for who she is, how she is, how this relationship is, you know, how we stand before God, how everything just seems so easy and so right. It's so rare, a very rare treasure, right? But like I'm saying, in most cases, it's not the case. Not in Nirvana's case, not in Meatloaf's case. You know, in fact, in Meatloaf, going back to Meatloaf before, right? Meatloaf died. He died not quietly. He's internationally famous a couple of years ago in COVID. But what was quiet about his death was the actual reason for his death. There was never really like an announcement of what took him down. But the rumor, the suspicion is, and it's related to things that like family members of his was posting online and la-da-da, that it was complications resulting from COVID-19, right? There's a little irony to this that it struck me when I found that out. Meatloaf, of course, like I mentioned earlier, is internationally renowned for his Bat Outta Hell LP, right? Bat Outta Hell. And he's taken down by the virus out of hell, out of a bat, right? You heard that, right? The idea where COVID-19 originated out of, what did they call it? Chinese wet market, bat meat in Wuhan, China, right? Some kind of infected bat meat started this pandemic that resulted in the deaths of millions of people. You heard that story, right? That tall tale? Because you know that's bullshit, right? But it's interesting. It creates a little irony around Meatloaf. And I wouldn't make Meatloaf out of bat meat, COVID or not. But that whole bat story is horse shit. You know it and I know it too. This is bioengineered, intentionally released, election year, all kinds of crap, right? Because the powers that be are just downright wicked and evil. Now, speaking of meat, right? Speaking of meat, which I guess we frequently do in this world, in Texas, and I don't know if this happens anywhere else, but I never seen it until I got here, right? Until I got here. Valentine's Day has another custom along with it, and that is the heart-shaped ribeye steaks, right? You go into your supermarket and they usually have out on display a bunch of ribeyes that are cut into shapes of hearts. Like you would get your heart-shaped box of chocolates, you get your heart-shaped box of ribeyes or package of ribeyes, right? I like that. I think that's really cool. I'm not doing that this year. I don't do really much anything, to be honest. Valentine's Day comes around, right? Like I said, we play it easy, right? I get my wife the box of candy. I get my wife the roses. And I get her a card. And that acknowledges the marriage. But our big day is the anniversary day. See, Valentine's Day is kind of extraneous from our perspective, right? And neither of us hold it in great esteem, but it does make her happy to be recognized, even if it's trifling things like flowers and chocolates and a card, you know. I do it. I've had relationships where we agreed just not to do it. In fact, my wife and I, we agreed not to do it, and every year I do it anyway. I love her. It makes me happy to see her happy, and she likes little things like that, you know. And so I do it. I play along with it, but I know in my Eastern mind, in my orthodoxy, that this is a secular bullshit rendition of the real orthodox thing out there, right? Now, speaking of the dozen red roses I keep bringing up, right? I got a story. I mentioned earlier there was going to be like the horrendous Valentine's Day story where everything goes wrong. You know, you got the lonely people in the world who sob and woe and pine over the fact that they're alone on Valentine's Day. Let me tell you, Valentine's Day don't always work out for the rest of us in the world, right? And here's the story, right, quickly as I can do. I call it the 11 Roses story, right? You might even be able to imagine somewhat where this is going already, but I will proceed. I will proceed, right? The 11 Roses story. Once upon a time, right? Once upon a time, when I was a damn Yankee up in the tri-state area of New York City, I had a girlfriend who I had met online. And she lived in Staten Island, New York, right? She was a New Yorker. I can't tell you exactly how long we were an item for. 2 months, maybe? It really wasn't all that long. It looked kind of promising. But all of a sudden, the wheels fell the fuck off. Oh, there's my F-bomb. I got to get one of them in there, right? It's a disappointing thing. When, you know, I look back and recollect. Negativity comes off. The wheels fell off of this relationship very suddenly and very unexpectedly, right? Valentine's Day was coming up. I'm with this girl who I've only known for really a matter of weeks, maybe as much as 2 months at that point. I'm trying to put it all together. She was with me at my work Christmas party, and we were still together come Valentine's Day. So it was right about 2 months. It would have had to have been about 2 months. That's what I remember. I remember there was a Super Bowl that I was with her at her parents' house watching. What year? I don't know. I think it was the Patriots and the Rams. I don't know. Early 2000s, after 9/11. In fact, this girl, she was in Lower Manhattan when that 9/11 stuff happened. She was on the Wall Street side, away from the Twin Towers, but just blocks away, right there. But anyway, here's what happened. She's at that office at work, Valentine's Day, right? The days before, the weeks before, leading up to this, I knew Valentine's Day is coming. And here, when you're dating somebody and it's Valentine's Day, you kind of got to juggle all kinds of considerations around. I mean, what is ample? What is adequate? What is over the top? This is a freaking headache, right? This is a headache for a dude on Valentine's Day at that stage of a relationship. You don't want to underdo it. You don't want to overdo it. And you can't really gauge the proper right center adequate amount of Valentine's Day custom shit, right? And but I made a thing of it. And it's fine. I tell you, I get a dozen roses for my wife, and I do this a couple of times a year. I go over to the supermarket across the street. They're like a dollar a rose. It ends up costing me like $15 for a dozen roses. They're roses with thorns. They're red. And even on Valentine's Day, they cost, Valentine's night, which is another story too. You go in the store, and all of a sudden, you got all these dudes in here mulling around like buzzards on a carcass, right? Trying to figure out what they got to bring home for their wife or their girlfriend or whoever. What? And but yeah, only $12 or $15 for a dozen roses. But when you go, you're up in New York City, and the year is like 2002 or 3 or whatever it was. You're ordering flowers in Manhattan for delivery to an office on the morning of Valentine's Day. The roses, a dozen roses cost you like $140, right? It was like that, $140. And then the delivery charge on it was like another $30. And then the taxes with the city and all, you know. It was a lot of money to have a dozen roses waiting for her at her desk at work. And that's how I was just going to start things, right? Very quietly, just send that, a card on it that said whatever the hell it said, making sure she knew it was from me, right? And then I figured when she got that, she would give me a call and say, oh, I got the flowers, thank you, all that. All day long, I'm waiting for this call that never comes. And you know what? All day long, she's waiting for a call from me that never comes because she never got the dang flowers. The florist never sent them up. I don't hear from her all day. And then finally, at night when I'm home, one of us broke down and called the other one. I don't know, remember how that went exactly. I called her, or she called me. It might have even been just like over email or text or something. Did we have text back then? Perhaps, probably. And I was like, whoa. I shelled out a lot of money for flowers. They should have been sitting on your desk when you got in the morning. I had it all arranged. Well, I didn't get nothing, right? As I was talking about before, you know, like you learn something new about a person you're dating when you get into a competitive situation. You start playing board games and things like that. Unexpectedly, you just start to see this other side of a person that you didn't see before. Well, holy shit, you know what? She never got a call from me from Valentine's Day, and she was completely beside herself. When I tried to explain to her, I was only trying to surprise her, and then I had ordered a dozen roses, and I figured you would call, you know, when... And none of that happened. She didn't back off and say, oh, okay. Well, it's disappointing that it went that way, but at least I know you tried. At least I know you cared. You thought of me. You spent money, right? And meanwhile, I'm on the phone with the florist. Like, what the hell? What's going on? You know, the next morning, I'm screaming at these people. She never got her flowers. I paid all this money. Oh, we'll get them up to her right away. Well, it's the day after. It's the 15th. You ruined it for me. You know, and they said, we'll give you a refund on it. We'll still send the flowers up and cover you. Is that good? It's as good as we can do. Thank you. They run the flowers up, and there was only 11 of them, not 12, right? But it was there. It was late. Everything got messed up, but she could see that I had done something about it. And I'm doing this from my desk in Jersey, right? I'm over the river somewhere in my office. I'm not there personally handling things. I'm calling and relying on some florist to do this shit. They screw it all up every which way under the sun. And does this girl give me a break? No, she completely loses her shit on me. You know, it's like, it was more than she can handle. That she didn't get a call, she didn't get roses, all that stuff. Her Valentine's Day was ruined, it was unromantic. And then the fixer would have been to get the flowers a day late, which wasn't good enough anyway. But then the straw that broke the camel's back was that there was only 11 and not even 12 roses. And that was it. That was the end of our relationship. She was so pissed off after all of that, in spite of my efforts to try, right? And that was just unfortunate sequence of events, right? She got those roses, and she was going to call me, and then I was going to tell her, look, I'm going to meet you. We're going to go out to dinner somewhere. All that, right? I'm dating, and I had to, like I said, figure out the right balance. I didn't know the woman well enough to know her sensitivity to this whole situation was going to be what it was. But we did not make it past February 15th morning when she got 11 roses on her desk. You know, that was the end of that. That's the 11 roses story. You like Valentine's Day? Say, I told you, Valentine's Day was meant for the married, not for the dating, not for the no-tell motel, not for none of any of that. And if you stick to the actual intended premise of it, that it's based on marriage and not any of this Cupid arrow up the ass shit, You don't find yourself in these kind of complications. Dating and Valentine's Day sucked more than being alone on Valentine's Day, and I can promise you that. I can promise you that because I've been on both sides of that plenty of times. Now, speaking of red roses, here's another red rose. This is kind of a Valentine's story, believe it or not. It's not a Valentine's Day story. It's not a Saint Valentine story. I don't usually name names when I'm doing these monologics, right? I don't name names. But in this case, I kind of have to, right? I kind of have to. It's my uncle, who I did love. He was my godfather. You've heard me talk about having a godfather that was an atheist, right? Curse on my life from my father, you know, who just destroyed our family and made sure that none of us had religion, you know, that kind of shit. Everything that foundational in your world as a kid growing up gets destroyed. Yeah. But he was my father. Uncle Valentine was my father's older brother, right? And he was a big dude. He was like 6'4", enormous strong hands. He was a machinist. He handled iron and steel all day long. You know, he's like constantly lifting weights, basically just doing his job. And very smart, knew few languages. Grew up in Europe. You know, he was trained in Germany. All the machine shop stuff that he knew. He ran his own business over here. He worked in the physics lab at Rutgers University for most of his career. Very smart, very strong, very short-tempered, very menacing, drank a lot. He was a powder keg of a dude, right? He always looked like he was about to explode. And just about everybody was on his bad side all the time, right? He was grouchy and grumbling all the time. I never had a problem with him personally. He was my uncle, and he treated me very well, right? And he treated my brother very well. He treated his family in general very well, except if you were his nuclear family. He mistreated his wife. He mistreated all three of his sons, right? They lived in hell. They lived in literal hell under this guy's domain, this guy's rulership. He was known as the Skull Crusher. The kids would wise off or do something stupid, which they did all the time. There were three burnouts, right? You know, three burnouts in the same household. They were always goofing off and messing things up. This guy would just take his big hand and just slap on top of the head with it and grab and hold their head. And they couldn't move or do nothing. He would just squeeze tighter and tighter and tighter. He was a Skull Crusher, is what he was called. It's the exercise we used to do for triceps in the gym, right? You have that special Skull Crusher bar, or you could use a curl bar, kind of monkey palm it. You're laying on your back, you put your elbows up, you got the weight like right on your head, right on your forehead, and then you push it straight up into the sky, and then you drop it back down to your forehead. And if it's too heavy for you, when you get wore out and you get start to get the burn in your muscles, you doink it off your forehead, and it crushes your skull. It's a Skull Crusher exercise, right? So my uncle, he was the Skull Crusher. His name was Valentine, like Valentine's Day. And this story centers around a place in Jersey called the Red Rose Saloon. I don't even know if it's still there. It was kind of like on the border of Bridgewater and Martinsville and Boundbrook, right? In that area on Route 22, the Red Rose Saloon. And that was his kind of dive bar that he would hang out. He worked, like I said, down in Rutgers University, which is Piscataway near New Brunswick. He was on the Piscataway side where his physics department was. His commute home was to Warren, New Jersey, Warrenville. And his last stop, basically, on the way home would be this Red Rose Saloon. It was a shot and a beer dive bar. I used to go in there when I was underage as a teenager and just sit there. It was dark, gloomy. Most of the guys that drank in there, it was a small place. They were contractors. They were construction workers, you know, mason laborers, landscapers, things like that. They'd go and hang out in there on their way home. Right? They had like a lunchtime, right? You go there for lunch, get a sandwich and a beer or two, go back to your job. On the way home, you go sit there, do the same thing, because you don't want to go home to your miserable life with your wife and kids and all that, right? So you go sit in a bar for a couple. I never understood that life, but people do that, right? My uncle Valentine was one of the people that did that. He stopped there and he would have a few beers before he entered into his domain. Of all the horrors, you know, the terrified people under his rule. And I hate to bag the guy. He passed away a couple of years ago. Personally, I was fond of him, but I was very close to one of my cousins, moderately close to another one. I knew what they were going through in the house. I knew it, you know, and it's sad to say. It's I pray for the guy's soul most days of the week. Right? I do. And my father also, right? In the Red Rose, this one particular late afternoon, early evening, I don't know how it started, and I wasn't there. I only heard tell, right? I only heard the story. Uncle Valentine's sitting there having his beers and shots, minding his own business. And I know he could be minding his own business because that's the way he was. I think out in public, he would just kind of have his head down. Drinking and thinking, and you know, somebody looked at him funny or said something off. The Skull Crusher was not a man to be trifled with. So I don't know exactly what words were exchanged in this mess, but I do know when he walked outside of that Red Rose and dusted off and jumped into his big blue Cadillac or Chrysler, he had this like sky blue beat the shit American car from like the late 60s, early 70s. It was like three blocks long. In my mind, it was an old Cadillac, but it might have been like an old Chrysler or Buick or something. One of those old luxury cars that were three city blocks in length. He drove around. It was perfect for him. A big dude with the big car, right? And he had the slick back hair parted on the side. You know, in the 60s, they kept it short. Like the collegiate look, you had the side-parted hair. It was all cut short on the side. And then when the 70s came, all those people with that hairstyle, it started getting longer. You know, like Waylon, his hair started getting longer. He was like that early in the 60s. And then later in the 60s, he had like this long, greased back, side-parted hair. Well, my uncle was kind of like that. He had that hair that was, whatever. He he just had this thing about him. He's not a man to dick around with. Like I said, he dusted off and he hopped in that big blue car and he drove down 22 eastbound to the next jug handle, which was Mountain Avenue, which turns into Morning Glory Road, and it deposits him basically at his house when he gets to Washington Valley, right? He's just like three houses down from there. He didn't have far to go, but by the time he got there, the police had him pulled over, right? I think he got a DWI, driving while intoxicated, and I believe he had some charges put up against him for assault and battery. He beat the shit out of four people in the Red Rose Saloon and just walked out of it, you know? Four different dudes who were probably construction workers. He beat the piss out of all four of them by himself and just calmly drove away like it was nothing. And then he had a period of life where he didn't have a license or anything like that, so it became difficult. But that's, you know, the epilogue of the story, right? But that's it. Uncle Valentine's Red Rose Saloon story. So you got the red roses, the Valentines, and then the big blue Cadillac, right? I was talking about playing Grand Theft Auto 5 with my wife. She's out there running around stealing cars and beating people upside the head and shooting people and all that. And I see her pass over stealing this big blue Cadillac. You know, it was like a 1969 Coupe de Ville two-door, right? Blue, but rusted, light blue, sky blue, like my uncle's big boat, right? It looked like his car. I'm looking at it, and she decides against it and jumps into like an SUV or something and drives away. I got it in my mind that I got my uncle Skullcrusher's car right there to be had, right? So she goes to bed, and I'm playing by myself. I start looking around to see if somebody's got that car. I find them. I beat the shit out of them. I steal the car, right? And I'm driving around like my uncle in this big rusty Cadillac. I went into the little mechanic shop that they have where you can upgrade the cars, get them fixed and everything like that. I did everything I could to that body. They would not take the rust out of it. So it just had to be this old beat up car. So much like his, right? Grand Theft Auto. The big blue car, right? All right, one more song before I go. One more song reference. I'm not going to sing again, okay? I'm not going to sing again, so you don't have to fast forward. You don't have to do the... never mind. I'm not going to go back there again. Reverend Horton Heat. You know Reverend Horton Heat. I talk about them every here and there, right? Jim Heath and Jimbo Wallace and then whoever they got playing on drums. Usually a trio. Sometimes they bring in a piano player. Very rarely. One of my all-time favorites, right? Texas guy. Jim Heath, very local. He's like two towns over from where I work, two towns over from where I live. He's like right down the street from where I go to church, you know? I ain't seen him. It's been a couple of years, right? But prior to that, I've seen him a bunch of times. I don't know, five, six times. And I would see him anytime I can. Usually when he's playing down in Dallas. I don't want to go down into the city anymore. Just that's part of the reason. But beside all that, they have a song called Reverend Horton Heat's Big Blue Car. And that came out 2002, which might be the year that I was with that girl in New York City with the Valentine's Day 11 roses and all that. I'm not sure, maybe. Lucky 7 LP, right? Lucky 7, 2002, Reverend Horton Heat's Big Blue Car. Straight up, psychobilly, good music, Reverend Horton Heat. So there you have it. There you have it. Blue Valentine's, part one, part two. A lot of stuff. I liked it. I liked the flow of this. The runaway train of thought kept on coming back to itself very nicely here. Hey, if you ain't got somebody to love, here's a message for you. Don't love yourself. Knuckle fucker.
Thank you for tuning into Postalin Monologics. Further information involving this project and archived releases of Post-Stalin Monologues can be accessed over the World Wide Web at poststalin.com. Comments, critiques, and inquiries may be submitted to Maverick through email at maverick88@poststalin.com.